Good afternoon, Eastern Washington. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the capital of free Washington, Spokane Valley, deep in the heart of the American Redoubt. Love to say it, God's country. In the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. And this is the year we wake up and take our freedom back, because our hope is not in man, but in Jesus Christ. And we can't end in prayer. We must also move to action. And as James 4:17 admonishes us, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him, it is sin. And it seems like we got a lot of that going on, at least lately anyway, especially in the halls of government throughout this country. And now from the front, your daily intelligence briefing on the international front. Once again, China's renminbi, or the yuan, now part of the strategic drawing rights. Also on the international front, Russia and Syrian troops getting very close to closing off the corridor ISIS is using to get oil out of Syria and into Turkey. Not really being well reported on in the news, the fact of the matter is that that is very close to actually happening. What will happen to Turkey then? Very curious. On the national front, very interesting today, Los Angeles school districts closing all across the city there based on a credible terror threat. Only it ended up being a hoax. Folks, we can't freak out about all of this stuff. We just need to be God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving Americans. Just go about our daily lives, self-reliant, well-armed, trained to use our firearms, legally carrying, exercising the Second Amendment, not as some kind of a theory, but as an actual right to be exercised every single day, a God-given right. And we don't need to be freaking out about things. Just need to take the normal steps we would as God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving Americans. And speaking of that, and by the way, ISIS is now gloating over what happened down in L.A. because now their terror campaign's working. But speaking of that, Syrian refugee issue, there were some people out there that were saying that Donald Trump was wrong. It was unconstitutional, including Napolitano, which is somebody I actually listened to quite a bit, saying that Donald Trump was wrong. It was unconstitutional to stop Syrian refugees. The Federalist Papers, especially Federalist 45, very clear on this point that the federal government is actually supposed to be focused on external objects. Well, the state governments were supposed to be focused on internal objects. This is the idea of the state sovereignty, federal delegated powers only idea. And the problem with those people that are saying it's unconstitutional to stop Syrian refugees, that's one of the things the federal government's actually supposed to do. They're supposed to vet people coming into this country. And it's interesting to me that those people would somehow say that the State Department couldn't cancel visas from a particular country. Well, of course they can, and they have. And now they're trying to say it's unconstitutional to stop Syrian refugees? That doesn't make sense. And especially when the vetting right now, and by the way, I think it was less than 1% coming are Christian, and they're the ones that are really persecuted, and Yazidi. But especially when the vetting is not being done. And it can't be done because the records don't exist to vet, number one. And number two, the CIA ceased in the 90s doing the in-country interviews and background checks of friends and relatives so they could corroborate stories and corroborate information on applications. So this stuff isn't even being done anymore. There's no way to properly vet them. So I think it's a little bit ridiculous that people are saying that's unconstitutional to stop them coming in. I mean, my goodness gracious. It's one thing that actually the federal government was delegated to do by the states. Also on the national front, well, it's no surprise. It should be a surprise to anybody, but yes, Hillary Clinton's emails were deemed top secret, or at least some of them. Why isn't she in jail? I mean, this just goes to show the double standard out there. She should be in jail. If it was any of us in Eastern Washington that did this, we would be in jail right now. Any of us. State representative, teacher, doctor, fireman, we'd be in jail right now. How come she's not in jail? I mean, this is the kind of thing that occurs that undermines the trust in the entire system. This is the kind of thing where people just say, is there anything we can really do? And I think there is. I'm going to get to that here in a second because I had a great debate today with a friend of mine on what we can be doing. But the bottom line is that what we are seeing is the coalescing of a one-world government, the coalescing of a one-world economy, and the coalescing of an elitist class that thinks that they are completely above the law, which is antithetical to the very principles of America. In the very idea that we are subordinate to something higher, God, Jesus Christ. So this thing about Hillary Clinton's emails, I think, is quite a bit bigger than just the fact that she had top secret emails. I mean, this is undermining the very fabric. It's laughing. It's spitting in the face of the very fabric of our republic. Also on the national front, global warming is debunked again. Oh, and going back to the international front, there's actually a climate agreement, which has nothing to do with climate. It has everything to do with control over you and me and everything that we hope to see happen for our kids and our grandkids in the future. Right after it was debunked again. Unbelievable. And they intentionally, and they actually admitted this publicly, they intentionally wrote it. They wrote it intentionally to bypass the U.S. Congress. I mean, they're actually just saying we don't care anymore about the system. We don't care about the Constitution. We don't care about the structure. We just got to do this to get it done. Folks, that is tyranny. The very essence of tyranny, that is the very essence of a dictatorship. And the fact they're admitting it publicly now, we are in a serious constitutional crisis. We are in a serious constitutional crisis right now. And I think everybody realizes it. I posted up this last week an article about the next American Civil War. Now, that might be very controversial to talk about, but it brought up a lot of great points about the irreconcilable differences in this country right now. That there is a group of people that believe the Constitution means what it says, and they want to abide by it. And then there's a group of people that don't want the Constitution to mean what it says, don't want to be part of that framework, don't want to be part of that process, and want to reinterpret it to fit their own agenda. And the problem is, the Constitution is essentially a compact. And if you are breaking it intentionally, and that's the thing that unites us, the Constitution's what unites us, then you're undermining the very fabric of the republic. And more importantly, the idea of we can't have civil debate anymore and political correctness, that's undermining the republic as well. So what we have is a group of people that literally don't want to abide by the original ideas undergirding the Constitution in our republic. And folks, there's no way really to go back from that. I mean, it's different. And there's no way to change their minds. In fact, they want to try to force us to believe the way they do. So anyways, a great article. It's on Facebook. Great discussion that followed up from that too. But the bottom line is we are in a serious constitutional crisis. And one of the reasons we're in a constitutional crisis is because we have people in this country who are intentionally breaching the compact, breaching the Constitution, which is what unites us, and doing it intentionally. Now, they have all kinds of fancy words and excuses for it, like, oh, that's old and antiquated, and this is a living constitutional. All they're really saying is we're undermining the Constitution. We're undermining the republic. And that's where the differences are today. So I'm not ashamed of standing up for, when I swore an oath, I gave my word, standing up for the Constitution and our republic. I've got to ask the question of those people that are trying to undermine it. Why aren't you living up to your word? And if you won't, then why do you even live here? Because the Constitution is what unites us. Which brings us to an interesting debate out there about Article 5. Now, I have been very silent on this. I've said it, mentioned it a couple of times, those of you that know me. But I want to be very clear on this. Folks, the Constitutional Convention is not the answer. Changing the words on paper is not the answer. We need to change as a people. We need to organize. We need to educate. And we need to enforce our God-given unalienable rights. That regardless of the Constitutional Convention, that's ultimately what we have to do. Because the Constitutional Convention, even if, and let's just do the hypothetical. Let's just say that they succeed in getting a convention. They succeed in making sure that we elect true constitutional conservatives and that there is an actual similar way throughout every state of electing those same delegates and ensuring that constitutional conservatives get elected. And let's say that after that happens, they safely navigate through the opening parliamentary procedures and rule votes, which are what are going to control that convention. Anybody else that tells you differently is lying, because parliamentary procedure, Anglo-Saxon common law, determines that that's when the rules are made. And then let's say they safely vote through and present unaltered amendments. You know, no amendments to their amendments that they're proposing. They safely get through all that. And then let's say they safely get it to the people and they get it ratified. We are back to where we are today, and that is enforcing what is written on paper, which is supposed to recognize and protect what is God-given. We're back to the same square one. They're not enforcing the Constitution right now. They're ignoring the Constitution right now. They're intentionally undermining the Constitution right now. They're going after and undermining our republic right now. None of that changes if you change the words on the paper. And so I'm adamantly opposed to Article 5 because I think it's a horrific distraction, not to mention it literally could be a civil war starter on its own. Now, some people accused me earlier today of that. That is a fearful position. I'm not in fear of anything. I'm already in the fight, and I know many of you are. We're already engaged in the fight. Folks, this is as Bálint Vazonyi, who is a Hungarian immigrant who lived under both Nazi rule and communist rules, he stated it this way. We've been in a 30 years war. I think it's much longer. I think it's probably 100 years plus war. That's what he called it. We're already fighting for the very existence of freedom and liberty, the very existence of God-given unalienable rights to be recognized and protected in our republic. The very existence of our republic, we're fighting for it right now. We're fighting for it right now, and you cannot tell me that changing the words through an amendment is going to change anything on the battlefield I'm on right now. In fact, I would counter and say that those people who are using the Constitutional Convention to say this is kind of a last-ditch effort are avoiding the fight that's going on right now. That's what the fearful position is, in my opinion. Now, I love all you out there. That there might be some of you that support it, but I got to tell you, it's not going to change anything because we come back to the exact same issue, and that is the enforcement, the organization, the education of our people to live freedom. And so we don't need to change the Constitution. I think the Constitution's written fine the way it is, just like the Ten Commandments. We just need to enforce those things that already exist. On the regional front, shifting gears, Colville, the transgender issue is going to come back up again. Now, some people are saying that there is a big change that needs to happen up in Colville. And I want to go through, and I'm going to take a while here because it looks like our guest is not going to be coming on like he was supposed to. We were going to have Joel Skousen on today. So I want to go through a couple things in detail. And actually, before I get there, I want to talk about real quick the NSA and bulk data collection, that supposedly the bulk data collection stopped. And that's not true. They actually just offshored it and went overseas to other countries. They're going to do it now. And there really isn't much of a change. Which, again, I think that just underlines what I was just talking about. They're intentionally undermining the Constitution, and they don't care. They don't care. And so all the folks out there on Article 5, folks, I love you, but they don't care. They don't care if the Constitution's amended. They'll ignore that too, or reinterpret it to fit their agenda. I mean, the plain language of the 10th Amendment, that those powers not delegated to the federal government or reserved to the states, that's being roundly ignored across the board. And now you've got a president who is ignoring the clear science that has debunked global warming, doing it intentionally, and intentionally drafting the agreements to go around Congress. Folks, let's call it what it is. Whether we're talking the NSA, whether we're talking the president, they are intentionally trying to destroy this country. They're doing it with a plan. They're not stupid. These are Harvard and Yale graduates, for goodness sake. And I think, you know, part of today, I think I'm going to go through Antonio Gramsci's plan and where this is coming from. So I'll stand by for that. I want to get through the rest of the intelligence briefing. I'm going to go through the grand plan of Antonio Gramsci and where all of this stuff is coming from. Because I think it's good to know the history. I think it's good to know where this came from. And you'll understand that none of this is by accident or somebody's just being dumb. This is all intentional. And are you falling prey to it? That's the other thing. And you got to check yourself, because sometimes things sound so good and they're so slick that you can fall prey to it. So I want to switch now to the regional front and talk about the transgender issue, which is, again, another undermining of this country. And it's actually part of Gramsci's plan, but I'll get to that here in a bit. The transgender issue, and I want to walk through this. At the federal level, there is no law that requires transgender locker rooms, etc. There's no law. All right, so let's get that out of the way. At the state level, there is going to be a whack, as I understand it. I was just briefed on this today by Research Mom. She actually left me a message. There's supposed to be a WAC that's going to be implemented, I think, on the 26th of December, and they always do that this way. You know, Federal Reserve was on Christmas Eve, transgender policies next day, you know. That's the way they do this kind of stuff. They always do it in the middle of the night. They always do it on a holiday when no one's paying attention. They always do these press releases on a Friday. Now, sometimes that can't be helped, but most of the time it's intentional. So the people don't do anything about it, or they miss it. It's interesting to me on that same note that, you know, and I've asked publicly this: if you're so proud of these things, if you think they are so morally right, and that you stand on such moral high ground, and that you really know that this is the right thing to do, then why on earth are you doing it in the dark of night or on a holiday when no one's looking? You are acting guilty. You are acting intentionally deceptive. So I think they know it. In fact, I know they know it. So this whole idea of all these guys must be dumb, we got to get that out of our minds. These guys are not dumb. They're not at all. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're doing it according to a plan. So I'm going to pull up a couple ideas on this transgender issue. And this is coming up again, I think, on Wednesday night up in Colville again. Folks, I'll make sure to post this on Facebook tonight. If you can make it up there, make it up there. But here's the bottom line. And nobody's been able to answer this. Okay, so let's say this WAC gets, you know, this is, and by the way, it's a rule. This is not a statute. This is an agency-made rule, not a statute. Okay. Let's say that that comes into effect. Okay, so that brings up a couple questions. First of all, before that, then there was no policy. So the school board up in Colville must have been lying because they said we have to adopt this policy when that can't be true if the WAC isn't even in place yet. Okay, so that's the first part of it. The second part of it is, even if it was true, why do you have to adopt a policy? If it's already law, it's already rule, why do you have to adopt a policy? Do you? Well, because there's sovereignty vertically. In other words, local governments, school districts in this case, have certain sovereignty, a certain sphere of jurisdiction. And that's why they have to adopt the policy. If they want to change that jurisdiction. But if it was law that applied to everybody, then they shouldn't have to. So the fact that they're saying, well, we have to adopt this, it can't be true in our system of government, in our vertical sovereignty system, in our republic. It can't be true. It can't be. Here's the third thing. They say, and by the way, there was some information that came out about the superintendent, I believe, that he had been fired from a previous school for failing to investigate some sexual molestation claims, apparently. And to such an extent, he was fired over it. There's a website that's up on that issue, and I think I'll make sure it gets up on Facebook here over the next day or so. But the bottom line is that the privacy of the other students, okay, so this is protected in our state constitution under Article 1, Section 7. The privacy of the other students is now going to be violated by this other student. So when you have a paradox like that, privacy has to win out. Otherwise, it's completely meaningless. So the right to privacy of all these other students has to win out. And it's not like there isn't another solution to this. They can offer a third bathroom to those that are confused and deal with it that way. They don't have to adopt a policy where they take the existing bathrooms that are already designated male and female and change it. They can find a third bathroom and then make that the one that the confused people go into. Here's the other interesting part. This is very clearly a mental issue, okay? And I want to back this up with science. I actually did the research on this 7 years ago, working on something for the Alliance Defense Fund, now the Alliance Defending Freedom, and did the research on all the different conditions regarding gender. I researched everything, all the endocrinal disorders, the very, very, very rare disorders, one of them where If you take a chromosomal sample from, like, let's say a person's leg, and then you take a chromosomal sample from their arm, there are two different chromosome compositions will come up. I mean, very rare. I mean, these are very rare disorders, right? Well, so I cataloged all this. We took a look at all the existing cases. We researched all of this in detail. And here's the bottom line. That gender can be determined in 99.99%. And that's literal. That's not a figurative number. That is a literal number. 99.99%. Gender can be determined by the presence or absence of a Y chromosome. So the different combinations that are out there, XXX, XX, XYX, all of these things, gender can be determined by the presence or absence of a Y chromosome. Y chromosome, male, absence of a Y chromosome, female. 99.99%. Scientifically proven, irrefutable, nobody can argue it. Period. Okay? There are some very rare disorders, very rare endocrinal disorders, and there's one really rare disorder, the one I was just telling you about. It's called chimerism, but there's only six people in the world, at least at that time when I was researching, that had it. And in the endocrinal disorders, I mean, those are decisions that need to be made with those folks and their doctors and their family and with prayer. But the bottom line is that is the extremely rare exception to the rule. So all of this has to be mental. Literally. It all has to be a psychological issue. Because physiologically, the science is absolutely 100% clear. There's no question about it. All right, so that's that one. Let's move on to the next. And it's simply this. No child should be forced into an intimate setting like a bathroom or a locker room with another child of the opposite sex. So think about this. It is an intimate setting. We talked about the right of privacy, but you're forcing kids into an intimate setting that they're not comfortable with. And typically if that happens, we train our kids to report that kind of thing where they don't feel comfortable. So those are some of the very clear arguments constitutionally, physiologically, emotionally against adopting these policies. And they just, it's simply not true that people have to adopt those things. Just simply not true. So when you're talking to your friends and family about this, and I've sent a lot of this information already up there to the folks up there in Colville and around Colville. We're talking to your family members about this stuff. Just use the science. I mean, these are facts. And it's not that there is no compassion for people that are so confused about things that they're having that problem. There's an option. You have a third bathroom that's specifically for them. You could use the teacher's bathroom. You could use, I mean, there's all kinds of different bathrooms you could do that with. But it doesn't mean you change, you try to make a reasonable accommodation. It doesn't mean you change the entire fabric of the school for the one person. Unless your intent and agenda is to undermine the entire fabric of the school. We'll get to that here in just a second. On the local front, had another windstorm come through. Not too many people had a power outage, but again, a great reminder to be prepared. Take your list down. How much food do you need? How much water do you need? What if the power was out for 90 days? And there is a new movie coming out, going to be released in 2016, called Amerageddon. You can take a look at it. I posted it up on my Facebook page. And on that movie, or in that movie, they talk about the threat of an EMP strike. In other words, that all power goes out across the country. And what happens if you have power go out for 90 days? What happens if you have power go out for 6 months? Are you ready in that scenario? And again, it's nothing to freak out about. Just make sure you have extra food. Make sure you have enough water. Make sure you have enough medical supplies. Medicine, if you need it. Make sure you have enough communication supplies so you can hear what's going on in the outside world. radios, etc. Make sure you have with something called a Faraday cage, which is a cage that protects against EMP. And there are many different options out there. And I'll be actually talking to somebody on one whole show about this issue because it's very complicated. And the fact is we don't really have enough data testing done in the United States. Now, the Russians tested this stuff back in the 60s, but we don't have the data. But it's just another example of how to be a God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving American. And so that is going to move us to Gramsci's grand plan. So that's the briefing for right now. Now I'm going to talk about, for the rest of the show, where all of this came from. Okay, where all of this intentional planning and attempts at destroying the country came from. Okay? Now, there are two schools of socialism. I'm going to oversimplify this. So please don't start texting and emailing me. I'm going to oversimplify this. There are two schools of socialism. One was more revolutionary socialism in the immediate. Lenin was of that sort. Stalin was of that sort. Actually, to a certain extent, Hitler was of that sort. And you say, well, wait a minute. Whoa, whoa. Well, remember, Hitler was a national socialist, all right? They believed that you could take over very quickly because there was just this inherent problem in the hearts of workers with the way that the system was run. That there was this inherent injustice. It was burning in the hearts of the workers and the proletariat, and they would just suddenly rise up. All you had to do is ignite the fire. Okay, so that was the more immediate revolutionary socialists. Then you had what are probably better known as the Fabian socialists, named after Roman general Fabius Maximus, if I recall correctly. And their idea was revolutionary over a long period of time. That the whole idea of Marxism was right, but the problem was if you did this really immediate revolution, there was going to be an immediate backlash from the productive class of citizens. They called them the bourgeoisie, right? But the productive class of citizens, and then your entire revolution would suffer because you had this immediate backlash. And most likely, you would actually fail because there would be this immediate backlash. So there's a guy named Antonio Gramsci, okay? He was born on the island of Sardinia in 1891. And he studied philosophy and history at the University of Turin, became a Marxist. He joined the Italian Socialist Party. And then he started his own newspaper called The New Order. Now, this is actually right after the First World War. Okay, so this is The New Order was the name of his paper. Okay, now, it's kind of odd and kind of creepy that the New World Order is kind of the thing that goes around today, and that's what the elitists refer to themselves as. So there's something that you could take away from that, that very likely all of the elitists, or most of the elitists, are communist or socialist in their ideology. They just don't say it. So I'm talking the ultra, ultra, ultra rich. Okay, so these are the billionaire elitists like George Soros, like Bill Gates. Very likely that that's what their true ideology is. And if you just read and listen to them, it really comes across that they're, at the very least, socialist. So he essentially becomes very active in politics, and Antonio Gramsci eventually goes to prison. While he's in prison, he writes volumes regarding Marxist theory, regarding Marxist strategy, and they're called the prison notebooks, right? That's what Gramsci writes. And Gramsci then says, if you want to win the world to Marxism, you've got to get people to voluntarily become Marxist. That's what they say. You voluntarily become Marxist. This is the whole central point behind Gramsci's idea and strategy. In other words, we're not going to force people to do it. We're not going to do this immediate revolution. We're not going to do it through force of arms, violence, or anything. We are going to make them want to become Marxists. Okay? And as Gramsci studied history, what he realized was that Christianity and the Judeo-Christian foundation for Europe, for America, was the single greatest obstacle to achieving that, because no one was going to voluntarily become a Marxist if they subscribed to the Judeo-Christian worldview. Now, even the people at that time that weren't Christians still subscribed to the worldview, or at least they didn't attack it. So Gramsci was identified, and he, you know, it's interesting, he identified correctly that the single biggest obstacle to that type of tyranny was Christianity. And the Judeo-Christian foundations, particularly of the Anglo-Saxon common law, but let's just say through the Western world. So he realized that he had to begin to undermine Christianity. And there's a great paper out on this, and I'm taking heavily from that. It's written by Father James Thornton back in the late 90s, outlining all of this stuff. It's just phenomenal, phenomenal paper. It's a must read. And I'll see if I can put a link up, if I can find the link here. But the bottom line is that the way that Gramsci was setting this up, this voluntary Marxism, was communism was not an ideology in which somebody believed. It was rather a criminal conspiracy in which somebody enlisted. So I know that sounds maybe contrary or weird, but the bottom line is he wanted people to voluntarily become part of this criminal conspiracy, because it wasn't really an ideology as such. It was merely, ideology was merely a tactic of mobilizing people to rationalize criminal actions. This is what Father Thornton put down, and I think it's very, very perceptive. Now, we also need to understand that there were banking elites in the West that actually allowed and helped communism to rise in Russia, but they also helped the rise of the Fabian socialists, particularly in England, which took this, again, longer view. So it wasn't like this was just done in a vacuum. It was just communists that did this. It was also helped along by Western elitists. And it's very well cataloged. There's many different books out there on it. I don't want to go into that right now, but there's some really great primary source documents out there on this. Okay, so what did Gramsci think we needed to do, in the Western world, to do this gradual encroachment of socialism so that people would voluntarily become Marxist? Okay? He realized that you couldn't argue the ideas of this class struggle with people back then, because most people ignored it. It wasn't that big of a deal to them. They believed in God, family, and country. And so he had to figure out a way around it. And this is where these guys get very slick and very perceptive in human nature. He realized that, like I said, civilization in the Western world and Christianity were inextricably bound together. Right? So he had to set out, and this is the way that people should plan, okay? So this is actually a decent way to plan and think about things. You establish your vision. In this case, that Marxism would rule the world for him. Then you establish your mission. That's to subvert the Christian faith. And then you establish, this is for Gramsci, and then you would establish your goals, your strategies, your tactics, and then today we call, you know, how you measure your success, your metrics. So that's how you plan. Vision, mission, goals and objectives, strategies, tactics, metrics, okay? So I want to go through each one of these. So his goals, we've already established his vision and mission. His goals were the following. It was first, and this is very, very interesting, over a period of generations to change the Christian worldview into one that was more harmonious with Marxism. So he wasn't trying to attack Christianity as much as he was trying to co-opt it. The second thing that he did as a goal, or had as a goal, he believed that instead of trying to marginalize yourself, you should have a broad spectrum of alliances with leftist groups. So in other words, you might not agree totally, or they might be soft leftists, but you had to have this broad alliance of leftist groups. Okay, so over a period of generations, make the Christian worldview more harmonious to Marxism. So in other words, co-opt Christianity. Then the second goal was to have these broad alliances of leftist groups. Okay, so yeah, you'll have the Communist Party, right? But there's going to be this broad alliance of other leftist groups, like the Democrat Party, like the Socialist Party, like the Industrial Areas Foundation, some of these other student groups that are out there. Black Lives Matter, for example. Some of these other Black Panthers, some of these other groups that you've heard out there, and wow, those are fringe. Well, they had this broad spectrum of alliance, and that's what they still have today. Okay, the next thing that he decided was a goal was to win the hearts and minds of the people, and not solely to, you know, force the power. So win the hearts and minds of the people. His fourth goal was to try to win a portion, not all, but a portion of the productive class of society. So like we talked about, corrupt and co-opt Christianity, broad alliance with leftist groups, win the hearts and minds of the people, and then seek to co-opt elements of the productive classes of society. And this is where the term useful idiots will come in, where people will, you know, think something sounds really nice. They don't do a lot of investigation. They send their kids to a Columbia University, and they get co-opted. That was part of his entire plan. It was a goal of his plan. And then if he co-opted part of the productive class of society, the bourgeoisie, then he would also, and this is the fifth goal, win some of their children, not all of them, but some of their children to the cause of Marxism. And so Gramsci's plan, if you these goals, and you listen to them, and you just realize they've met most of their goals. Co-opting the productive class, and then going after and co-opting some of their children as well. And that's why you'll have kids that come from a rather conservative, Bible-believing family. They go off to a college, and all of a sudden, they're totally co-opted. They come back, you don't even recognize. You can't even have a rational discussion. I actually had a friend of mine came back from college, and my goodness, it was amazing. Okay, so those were the five goals. Okay, so there are a couple more. There's actually two more. The next one was to gain control of the organs of culture: churches, education, newspapers, magazines, electronic media, literature, music, visual arts, even, I guess I would say, sports, everything. You get the idea. It was the sixth goal. He called that cultural hegemony. He wanted to have cultural hegemony. And the other ones I talked about were kind of more political hegemony, but he wanted to have a cultural hegemony. He wanted to have that control over all those organs of culture. And then the seventh goal was to gain control over the influencers, those people that assimilated information, put out information, moved people to action. So to specifically target individuals, influencers, and co-opt them as well. And that's why you'll see some politicians, they'll go into office, great, they have a great voting record, and then all of a sudden they'll vote socialist. And you'll be like, well, where did that come from? Well, as part of this whole plan, this was one of the goals, was to co-opt those folks. All right, now moving on to his strategies. Well, he had a process by which he could do this. So I'm going to talk about the strategies first, then I'm going to move over to the tactics, because I think it's important to distinguish between the two. So the first main strategy he had was to undermine all traditional culture elements. So all elements of traditional culture needed to undermine it. And that was the first strategy he had. Second strategy he had was to undermine marriage and the family, which were the very building blocks of society. All right? So it sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it? It sounds pretty familiar. Okay, the third strategy he had was to clearly attack and reinterpret and distort the expressed and fundamental principles embraced by our founding fathers, the idea of God-given unalienable rights. In fact, I'll tell you a story about that. When I was in law school, we didn't read the Constitution. But one day, and yeah, I'm sure that just raised the eyebrows of a lot of people out there. One day we had a professor put up the Declaration of Independence on the board. And I thought, wow, we're getting somewhere. And it said, we are endowed, ... with certain unalienable rights. And I said, Professor, I raised my hand. I said, Professor, what's in the ellipses? That's not relevant. Da, 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 da. Well, he intentionally edited the Declaration of Independence for their agenda. Okay, fourth strategy they were using was to disappear all memory of our old civilization and old way of life. So in other words, erase the memory of freedom and what freedom looks like. Erase the memory of Jesus. I mean, let's just be blunt. It was to erase the memory of our old way of life and our civilization. Okay, fifth strategy was to Marxize, and this is from Father Thornton again, quote, Marxize the inner man. In other words, literally change the soul of someone to Marxism. Okay, so those are the strategies. Now, here are the tactics that he used. Okay, first he would go, and this is going to sound, and this is, remember, this is written, okay, right after World War I time frame here. He's in prison in World War II and all this. Understand the time frame here, this 20 to 30 year period. It's written back then. It's not written today. Okay, so here's the tactic that he wanted to use. First thing was, he wanted to change churches into ideologically driven clubs that intentionally stressed social justice and egalitarianism. That's a fancy way for saying that everybody needs to have an equal share. In other words, not equal opportunity, but an equal share as in an outcome. And then he wanted to diminish worship and trivialize worship in the church and modernize age-old or antiquated doctrinal teachings, or diminish those teachings to the point of irrelevancy. Now, folks, sitting in Olympia, that is exactly what has happened today. Our churches are afraid to talk about the issues of the day. Our pastors are afraid to talk about the issues of the day, and not all of them. I know there's many of you out there that are listening right now that stand up every Sunday and say, no, not in my church. I'm going to preach the Word of God. I'm going to preach the truth, and amen. But there are some churches out there that are afraid to preach that homosexuality is a sin, afraid to preach that abortion is a sin and murder, afraid to preach that socialism, that tyranny is akin to slavery, and that that's unbiblical. And so it's worked. This tactic has worked in the churches, and that was one of his tactics, the first tactic, actually, that he really wanted to implement. The second tactic was to replace genuine education. In other words, a classical education where you actually memorize things, you learn logic, formal logic. And I can't tell you how many arguments, discussions I get with people, and they are not using formal logic. They were not taught how to think. They were taught what to think. And they replace, and this is his tactic, to replace genuine education with a dumbed-down, politically correct curriculum. And then, here's key, reduce the standards to the lowest common denominator so we don't expect the best of our young people. Third tactic he wanted to use the mass media as a tool of mass manipulation and agenda. Now, there's a video out there. A great friend of mine named Steve sent it to me of of literally like 3.5 minutes of, I think it was like 30 different news stations saying exactly the same words on a story. And these are from all over the country. And the question at the end is, do you really believe now that all the media doesn't get their information from one source, or at least some of their stories from one source? Very interesting. The bottom line is, third tactic was to use the mass media as a tool of mass manipulation. Fourth tactic, ridicule, morality, decency, and virtue. In other words, ridicule it as old and antiquated. Ridicule morality and virtue. Now, there's a movie out there like The 40-Year-Old Virgin. They're just ridiculing virginity as something bad. As an example, that was one of the tactics of Gramsci. Fifth, portray traditional clergymen as hypocrites. In other words, smear. And this actually goes into politics too. Smear traditional value leaders as hypocrites. Now, all of us are hypocrites. All of us are sinners. But they're actually trying to create their own morality by going and attacking folks out there and saying, hypocrisy is the worst of all sins. Very interesting. That was his fifth tactic. Sixth tactic. This was to take virtuous men and women, leaders among us that are virtuous, that are heroes, and portray them as unenlightened, as stuffy, smear their reputations. It's like what happened to Ben Carson. Smear decent people's reputations as if they're hypocrites, if they're liars. You know, that's what they want to do. Portray them as if they are hypocrites and liars, etc. Okay, seventh tactic he wanted to use was to destroy ideals and present our youth not with heroic examples, but with deliberately and aggressively degenerate ones. And I was watching a TV series called Hell on Wheels, and my goodness, if that doesn't embody exactly, this person isn't heroic, they're just degenerate and aggressive. And portray that as kind of heroic. Seventh tactic, that's what it was. Okay, eighth tactic, portray traditional Christian culture as repressive and racist, and then replace that with the more enlightened multiculturalism, this kind of unsoiled primitivism. Very interesting. We see that happening all over the place. Okay, ninth tactic, portray marriage as a patriarchal plot to repress women. So in other words, destroy marriage by literally saying it's really a plot to keep women down. Okay, number 10 tactic. Depict the family as a dangerous institution epitomized by exploitation and violence. And it's interesting that you will see family as a word now being replaced by the word household. Very, very interesting. And one of the last things that he decided needed to be done, and this was kind of an overarching thing, was use government money, whatever government form it was, use government money to subsidize anti-Christian, anti-traditional lifestyles. There's an old saying in government that if you subsidize it, you'll have more of it. Subsidize birth control, you have more of it. Subsidize abortion, you have more of it. Very interesting. But the bottom line is, that was all part of Gramsci's grand plan. The goals, the strategies, the tactics, and we see it literally playing out today in almost every area of our lives. Now, are we falling prey to it? Are we becoming part of that productive class that's falling for this stuff? Or are we standing up and saying, no, that's not true? God Almighty gave us freedom and liberty. God Almighty gave us the right to bear arms, the right of free speech, the right to peaceably assemble. These are God-given rights, the right to property, the right to life, the right to liberty. All of these things, they were given to us by God. And that Christianity, that the Judeo-Christian foundations of our country and Anglo-Saxon law are what have made us great. And I want to end on that point with a story. There's a book called Jesus in Beijing. In the very first part of the book, I believe it's on pages 8 and 9. David Aikman, the author, tells a story about how they went to Beijing and they were given a briefing at one of the universities there. And very uncommon, but interesting, they were briefed on the fact that the Chinese had done this study on what made the West great. Was it the West technology? Was it its economic system? Was it its political system? What made the West great? So they went through all of these things, and in typical Chinese fashion, very disciplined, very, very clearly organized, they went through every single thing in this study, and they came to one conclusion. And this was briefed, according to Jesus in Beijing, according to the book. This was briefed to them that they realized it wasn't their technology, wasn't their political system, wasn't their economics that made the West great. It was Christianity. It was their religion. So even the Chinese, communist, atheist Chinese, figured that out. I hope we do too. Well, thank you to everybody that listened in today. Really appreciate everybody out there that's been praying for Patriot Radio. Remember to continue to pray for a revival of repentance. And really, over these holidays, get near to your family. And may God bless all of you. And may he make this generation the greatest one.